It is Sunday, July 28th, 2013, and this is episode 28 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell. As usual, the thoughts and opinions I express on this podcast are mine and do not represent those of my employer. So I'm actually recording this a couple of days early. I'm going to be on vacation, and I've learned that people really like it when podcasts are released on a regular and predetermined basis. So this is my attempt to keep on schedule. So earlier today, we had some very, very sad news. Barnaby Jack, who is a very prolific hacker, especially in the embedded device arena, probably best known for some ATM and medical device hacks, was apparently found dead in his hotel room today. There's no indication of what happened, but from what I read, there is not a suspicion of foul play involved, so read into that what you will. Unfortunately, I never had a chance to meet Barnaby, but I'll tell you, I watched a lot of his videos and I followed him online, and I'll tell you, he is a very brilliant person, and I think someone that we will be learning from for quite some time to come. All right, moving into stories. The first thing I want to talk about is a post on Tripwire's site. Apparently, Tripwire worked with Ponemon to conduct a survey about risk metrics. And while the survey is quite lengthy and I haven't read it all, there is one thing that really stood out for me, and that is some survey results about whether or not risk-based security management is an art or a science. And what struck me as very interesting is that I'd say roughly the lower down the totem pole you are, the less high up in an organization, is the reciprocal of that, the more likely you are to believe that risk-based security is a science. And conversely, if you are more into enterprise risk management, you are inclined to believe it is an art. And there also seems to be some correlation to the kind of industry you're in. So industrial, which tends to be historically less technically sophisticated, is apt to view risk management as more of a science, whereas on the other end of the spectrum, tech and communications and health and pharma more predominantly view it as an art, although it's a little closer to half and half at that end of the scale. Now, I'm generally pretty skeptical about Ponemon studies for what are hopefully pretty obvious reasons, and basically asking lots of different people their subjective opinions about a quantitative question does not yield a quantitative result. It basically just yields people's feelings about a particular thing. And that really, in my mind, says more about psychology than it does actually about anything concrete and technical and useful for the purposes of strategic planning. Now, I will say that in this particular circumstance, this is probably interesting and valuable because you're essentially polling people about their subjective beliefs about risk management, which I do think is a valid thing. And I think we can take some things away from that. And specifically in this case, there's a bit of a dichotomy between the two ends of the spectrum, one side seeing security risk management as a hard science and the other viewing it as a art. And what's particularly interesting to me is the constituency that's more in the realm of actual risk management tends to view it more as an art than a science. And the people on the front lines tend to view it more as a science than an art. And I think that should possibly guide us in how we approach our assessments of the effectiveness of our risk management programs. Specifically, what explains that discrepancy? Clearly, the people down in the lower levels feel like there is hard data to be had, but people at the upper levels don't particularly see that. And so it leads me to wonder what exactly are these enterprise risk people doing that is so disconnected from the rest of the business that drives them to view it as an art rather than a science. And this has some specific interest to me because I've really started to get very interested in the very quantitative methods of risk management, more from an actuary perspective. And it concerns me to see this kind of a result where you have someone who arguably should have that very quantitative and actuarial perspective on things, basically claiming that what they're doing is an art, which to me means heat maps and very non-scientific things, which probably isn't all that surprising given what we know actually happens. All right, well, enough of that. Moving on, McAfee appears to be trying to get past the horror that was the episode that happened a few weeks ago with John McAfee explaining how to uninstall McAfee antivirus. And apparently the exit button is a report on the economic impact of cybercrime and cyber espionage. And it's an interesting report. It's relatively short. To net it out, they basically claim there's somewhere in the neighborhood of $400 billion a year worth of negative impact or drag on the global economy due to crime and espionage online. But the bulk of the report explains their methodology for arriving at that number. And I think it's actually pretty interesting to see the thought process. You can definitely disagree with certain parts of it, but it's really worth a read to understand how they got there. And you know, I would suspect they're probably not far off the mark. In the U.S., for instance, they indicate that there's about a 0.3% impact on unemployment due to crime and espionage. So, you know, that's not trivial. I don't understand enough about macroeconomics and politics and whatnot to make a thoughtful counter argument to why what they're presenting is wrong. But, you know, certainly it seems within the ballpark. All right, the next bit of news I want to talk about is a blog post on Dumbala, on Dumbala's site. And this one is titled, "The Fallacy of Targeted Attacks, Advanced Threats, and Sandboxing-Based Technologies." And this is an interesting article because it essentially picks apart the thought process that, you know, we can effectively classify and contain malware using sandboxes, and kind of decomposes why that's a wrong-headed thought process, that if you are a targeted attacker, you're going to understand how to detect those sandboxes, and you're going to know that a sandboxed environment is generally intended to analyze your malware, and so you're not going to burn your key advanced malware. You're going to slot in some commodity thing that, once it feels like it's actually running in a real environment, it then goes out and pulls down the real thing that does the heavy lifting. Now, the one possible fallacy I see in the report is actually that the preponderance and explosion of virtual environments is in legitimate business settings is probably now starting to weigh on the minds of these attackers, because now you can't dismiss out of hand that a virtual environment is a container being managed by a researcher. It could very well be a virtual desktop infrastructure. It could be a virtual machine sitting on someone's workstation that they use to fence off different things. So it's no longer a home run that you necessarily want to ignore virtual machines. And I think going forward, malware authors that do that are going to start missing some opportunities. But be that as it may, the point of the article is more about the need to close the amount of time that malware actually exists on our networks. So, you know, we have to accept the premise that it's going to get in, and now we need to focus on reducing the amount of time it takes for us to detect it and get it out of there. And I completely agree with that premise, and it is something that we all really need to get a lot better at doing, and certainly some of us do it better than others. All right, this next article hurts my head. It is in Tech Republic, and some of the people that posted this and were talking about it commented about not realizing that Tech Republic was still around. But in any event, the title of the article is "Why Security Metrics Aren't Helping Prevent Data Loss." And some of the problem I have with this is that right out of the gate, the argument is based around the explosion of data loss events as reported by DataLossDB, and pins a pivotal point in 2009 when some focus was apparently applied to security metrics. And so in the 2008 to 2009 timeframe, you see a fairly precipitous drop in data loss incidents. But then after 2009, you see a pretty dramatic rise. And so the bulk of the article talks about, well, what happened from 2008 to 2009? Well, that was the implementation of security metrics that dramatically dropped data breaches because people were suddenly caring about it. And well, what happened from 2009 to 2012 when you see a gigantic jump? Well, security metrics kind of fell apart, and people didn't understand where they needed to be investing. So I really think the whole article and the whole premise doesn't string together very tightly in my view. I guess the point is that there probably are macro factors that drove those numbers, the data loss numbers, that didn't have anything to do with metrics. And so they may have been related to the rise of Anonymous or many other factors that don't have a whole lot to do with security metrics directly. Now, I don't mean to dog on security metrics because I think they are important. I do truly believe that most people do them wrong. And the point of the article is to say that, you know, we have some really fundamental problems with metrics. And one of them is that we have these technical IT security metrics that are kind of orthogonal to how business people think about things. And so when we try to present our metrics to business people, it goes over their head, or they get that eyes glazed over look, and it doesn't sink in. And so, you know, I think the author makes the point, it would be totally unacceptable for a CEO to not have the time to make financial metrics consumable by the business leaders. And so the premise goes that as IT people, we need to get more in the mode of talking in business terms. And, you know, I've been in IT for a long time now, and we've been having this conversation for a very long time. I can remember having this conversation in the 90s. But there is another aspect that gets under my skin a little bit. And, you know, I'm as much of an advocate of talking in business terms as anybody else you'll find. But the thing that bothers me about this line of thinking is that, especially the point about the CFO not communicating his metrics in terms that the business people can understand. The CFO is communicating numbers. Well, what do we know about most business leaders and most CFOs and COOs? They tend to be MBAs, and they all tend to speak a common language around financials and numbers like that. So as IT people, we have our work cut out for us in this respect, because unlike the CFO communicating his numbers to the CEO and the COO, we don't have that common dialect and understanding and background with some of these business leaders. And so it becomes really very difficult, and we have to start figuring out how to communicate security risk in terms that are material to the business. And so, for instance, if your company makes razor blades and you're talking about what could potentially happen if you don't invest in a particular security program, maybe it makes sense to talk about the risk in terms of razor blades. So I guess to net it out, I agree in principle with the thought that says we have improvements to be made with metrics. I do think that one bit that is not well addressed in here is that we also don't do a very good job of understanding the purpose of metrics and how to design metrics, and how we really need to take a step back and define what we are trying to accomplish, and then let that figure out what the metrics need to be, and then go off and build a program to collect and measure those metrics, because that's how we're going to be able to measure the effectiveness of our programs or determine where we're going to invest in the future, or those sorts of key business decisions. You know, the number of spam emails that you got last month might be really easy to collect, and it may be a very large number, but if you're not going to hinge any decision off of it, it really isn't material, and showing it to your CEO or vice president or what have you probably isn't going to get you real far. So metrics are good. The appropriate metrics are better. Being able to communicate them up is even better yet. But not falling into the trap of trying to tie your story to totally unrelated, or at least highly likely to be unrelated, macro trends in the industry is very problematic to me, and I just have a very hard time with this article and how they have tied metrics to data loss incidents. All right, moving on. Another story from Tripwire. This time it's about insurance. And I spoke a little bit about insurance last show, not a ton. This one points out that the insurance company came knocking, looking for some information about their cybersecurity defenses. And to me, it seems kind of interesting, although not necessarily surprising, that they are using the SANS 20 as a framework to evaluate the effectiveness and whatnot of their customers' controls. What is a little scary to me is that there doesn't appear to be any sense of depth to the questions that they're asking. So they ask a question, for instance, do you have firewalls in place? And if you say yes, they ask the question, is it configured with the default factory ship configuration, or did you customize it? And that appears to be the extent of it. Now, you know, this, from reading the article, it sounds like this is actually considerably more detailed than what it's been in previous years. So maybe they're on a trajectory to get to a much more sophisticated level of understanding. Which kind of says to me that if we don't get our houses in order, it's probably going to start impacting some non-trivial, previously wholly separate issues like insurance. If we don't have our IT shops and our security controls set appropriately. So right now, you know, it doesn't, the two are kind of largely independent of one another. But let's say down the line, if we don't have the right ID management practices in place, you know, possibly that could incur a significant penalty in your insurance policy. And if security issues at all have any kind of ability to impact something that could cause your insurance company to pay out a claim, I would think that's appropriate. So it will be interesting to see how this develops over the next couple of years. And I would imagine some of the more sophisticated insurance companies will figure it out sooner. I mean, you look at, what is it, Progressive with their snapshot deal, right? So, you know, they want to see much more detail about how you drive in order to figure out how they're going to charge you. And so I think we'll probably start seeing that on some of the other larger scale insurance policies like, you know, E&O and whatnot, where they want to have a lot better understanding of the mechanics of your business. They probably already have a much better understanding of other parts of the business, like the, you know, the money making parts and where those risks are, but they are just starting to get their feet into the water on the IT security part. All right, the next story is from InfoWorld, and the title is "The One Security Technology That Actually Works," and that security technology is whitelisting. I've been a fairly significant proponent of whitelisting or application whitelisting for a while now. It is a pretty good technology. I think it's foolish to say that it's bulletproof. Certainly there are ways around it. We saw earlier this year, in fact, some advanced adversary found it easier to get inside Bit9 and steal some of their signing certificates so they could send some targeted malware to one of Bit9's clients than it was to try to figure out how to get around the whitelisting technology itself, apparently. So for whatever it's worth, I definitely think it is worth looking at as a very valuable control point. Again, it's not foolproof. It still makes sense to have your defense in depth. I'm not taking away from that. I wouldn't recommend you install application whitelisting and uninstall your antivirus or anything foolish like that. However, you know, there was a really good talk I heard from Dave Vitale a while ago, and sometimes Dave Vitale rubs me the wrong way. I don't know Dave Vitale at all. He doesn't know me, but he was interviewed by, I think it was Ryan Narain on Ryan's podcast, and Dave was talking about how we need to get security technology to the point where people don't have to worry about clicking on the wrong thing. And in the context, it was specifically around phishing and watering hole attacks and the debate about security awareness education and how effective that was. And this kind of flared up earlier in the year. But Dave's point was, and it's a good one, that we ought to be designing systems that don't require people to not click on something as a primary method of security control. And so I think application whitelisting moves us pretty dramatically in that direction. Again, it's not perfect. However, it's probably a heck of a lot closer than you're at right now if you're not already doing application whitelisting. And, you know, keep in mind, a lot of environments have administrator rights removed, and so they're lulled into a false sense of security because, hey, people can install software. And there's a couple of things to keep in mind with that. Number one is, I'd just say from a high-level perspective, removing admin rights and application whitelisting are complementary. They're not really duplicative, although definitely in my view, if you're not removing admin rights, application whitelisting is probably a pretty good way to go, although because you have administrator rights, you can certainly uninstall your whitelist engine. But if you can get past that, it's a good thing. Anyway, if you're running without admin rights, you can still download software and run it in the context of your user. So you can download a little game or something that doesn't require an install, doesn't require you to put things into the, you know, the program files or the Windows directory, and it'll run all day long. And personally, I've seen a number of pretty horrible malware outbreaks in environments where they have not had admin rights, and these pieces of malware run in the context of the user. It doesn't take over the system. In fact, it doesn't trigger until the user logs in. So that should tell you that there are some valid reasons that you would want to have both technologies or both protections in place. The obvious downside is that, well, you know, there's often some legitimate need for people to be running different things. And so you can incur a fairly high overhead in responding to people's request for whitelisting things that are not currently permitted. So I guess there you have it. I am on a podcast saying that people should be taking a look at the software equivalent of a Blinky box. And I know that's a horrible, terrible thing for me to say, but, well, you know, what can you do? And speaking of Blinky boxes, Boy, that was a good segue. Krebs on Security has a pretty interesting article that was posted today titled Security Vendors Do No Harm, Heal Thyself. And the net of the article is that Symantec had kind of quietly patched a number of significant vulnerabilities in some of its security hardware that was reported to them by a researcher. And so there was the appropriate responsible disclosure dance was done and whatnot. However, apparently these were pretty significant bugs, and if they had been taken advantage of by some bad people, they would have been pretty serious. And so I raise this because a lot of times we look at especially security devices like a firewall or an IPS device or what have you as kind of a black box. Again, especially ones that come from a security provider. But we have to be cognizant that they have their own risk. And so as we figure out how we're going to put them into our network, we ought to be thinking, how are we going to fence off the management port and basically overall reduce the footprint of that device just like you would any other system. And also, keep an eye on your patches and whatnot on those things. They are vulnerable, or they can be vulnerable, just like any other piece of technology in your environment. But sometimes I will come into an environment and I will see a firewall that has been running, kind of sitting in the corner for 5, 6, 7 years, and no one will touch it. It's just kind of there, and who knows what it's vulnerable to, and who knows if it's had something bad happen to it already. And the last story for tonight is a announcement from Verizon that they are releasing into the public domain. I'm not actually sure what the licensing is, so it might not really be public domain. But they're releasing the Verizon Community Database. And so this is a pretty cool thing where they are releasing a pretty large set of classified in terms of broken down into classifications, not classified as in top secret, a list of classified incident data that we as security people can download and run models against, and as they say, we can ask questions of the data, trying to figure out maybe what things or what attributes of this data set are relevant to our infrastructure, things that might help you determine where you want to apply controls based on the kinds of events that you've seen internally. So you can compare your own incident metrics versus this public set and see what comes out. And maybe that can help extrapolate some things that will answer some questions on what things are strategically important to focus on and that sort of thing. I think personally, more data is always better. And this is a really good thing, especially for me as I, again, get more interested into the quantification of risk management. So anyway, that is the show for today. I definitely appreciate your time in listening to this. I hope it is beneficial as always. I'm very happy to announce that Richard Baitlick's book, The Practice of Network Security Monitoring, was released this past week, and I was able to send a copy to the person who won the contest I did a couple of months ago. And I'll probably do one again, although I'll say there's a whole lot more people listening to the podcast now, so there might be some more stiff competition than before. But, hey, it's still only 10 people, so that's not so bad odds, right? Anyhow, I again, wish you a very good week. I will be back next week with a whole new set of stories. Until then, if you have any ideas, any critiques, comments, stories that you'd like me to cover, send me an email, info@defensivesecurity.org, or on Twitter, @DefensiveSec. You can follow me on Twitter, @MaliciousLink. The website is www.defensivesecurity.org. You can find the show notes, which include links to all the stories I talked about today and all the previous shows as well. And with that, I am out of here for the week. Take care. Bye.